If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
There are 8 Republicans seeking their party's nomination to become Missouri's next Secretary of State. One of them, Mike Carter, a municipal judge from Wentzville, is no stranger to a campaign. Carter has run for various state government positions in Missouri across the years, including a run for lieutenant governor in 2020 and for state senate in 2022. On this episode of Politically Speaking, Carter talks about why he's running for Secretary of State, as well as how he would run the office if elected. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio State House and politics reporter Sarah Kellogg. Joining me in St. Louis, he is St. Louis Public Radio's political correspondent,
Jason Rosenbaum.
And our guest today, he is a municipal judge from Wentzville, Missouri, and as Jason says, one of the thousands of Republicans running to be Missouri's next Secretary of State.
Mike Carter, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for being on the show. Let's get right into it. We have a lot of questions. You know, you're no stranger to running for positions. Back in 2022, you narrowly lost the Republican primary for State Senate District 10 to Senator Travis Fitzwater. And in 2020, you ran for Lieutenant Governor. Why are you running for Secretary of State?
You know, it really has been a theme. I did kind of skip outside of the lane in that 22 election you mentioned, where I did drop $500,000 and went on the radio and TV and some things I had really never done before. And I had an emphasis in strategic communications, taught marketing for 14 years. And really what my goal has always been is to kind of sneak into office in an unconventional yet creative way. If I can touch the eyes and ears of the voting constituency and make it into office without other people's hands in my pocket or my hands in their pockets, and be answering only to those folks who make their way to the voting booths and then the rest of the citizenry, obviously. I just thought it'd be unique, not being beholden to 4 or 5 people who've got the bat line to a politician who they, you know, grease the palms of and that kind of thing. I just want a unique opportunity to end up there, and having got there with some of my own, you know, choosings or marketing prowess or whatever it might be this time. For instance, I'm doing a lot of texting, I think robocalling. I've got some different radio here and there running, some advertising through Facebook and digital. I really basically would like to show that you could win and become an elected official by a laptop on the couch in your living room. No Lincoln days, no glad handing. Just end up in office and say, well, it could be done.
And so why Secretary of State? It's not like there wasn't a, you know, wide variety of positions that you could have run for this year. Why this one?
I do a lot of amateur polling, and when I ran for lieutenant governor in 2020 against Mike Kehoe, I still have a voicemail he sent me. I got 26% of the vote, 158,000 votes, and I did most of that in all the ways I just tried to describe to you.
You actually won some counties, too. Oh. We actually, like, 3 or 4 counties.
Yeah, I thought it was 5 to 8. I won Carter, as you might guess. And my family is from down in Carter County.
Wait, hold on a second. Your name is Mike Carter and your family is from Carter County.
Yeah, that's right.
That's just too rich for my blood, but continue, sir.
Yeah. And, I got a voicemail from Mr. Kehoe. It went through, he beat, the bejesus out of me with, you know, 2/3 of the vote, but they were very surprised. I got 158,000, 26% or 30% of the vote. And I did all that in the ways I mentioned a little bit ago. And he said, you know, we don't know how you got that many votes, but we'd like to get together and learn how. And so if I had that same 158,000 votes this time for Secretary of State, then I am Secretary of State. All I got to do is just keep that same amount of votes, as you guys were kind of alluding to with the 8,000 people or 1,000 people running for office. That's going to be the magic number, 26, 30, 32, whatever. And I've already been there if I could just keep a hold of those folks. And so that's a long-winded way of saying I identified the Secretary of State's office as having the least amount of competition, the least amount of dollars dedicated to it, and the largest opening for me to repeat what I did in the past and just ascend right to the position.
What do you think you would offer as Secretary of State that is different from the 7 other Republicans running for the post?
Just all the things I alluded to earlier, being in the office, not having anybody who's giving me money because I'm in the middle of my term and they hope I can do some things for them in the event that I lose. Not having given me a bunch of money because I was the head of one of the bodies of the state legislature or the General Assembly, hoping that I'd get what I would want as a result of helping them out and making their way, you know, to whatever office they chose. It looks like some of these folks have done, you know, very nearly what I was explaining to you a moment ago, where they looked at the field. Some of them were already signed up for lieutenant governor or Senate congressional districts, and they decided, well, you know, I think I'll make a change. They identified some of the same things I was saying to you, except they had a way to bring together, you know, several hundred thousand dollars of folks giving them money and maybe buying them at some level, or, you know, just using the lobbying process as is accepted throughout the United States. But if I get in there, I'll have to answer just to the folks in the voting booth. I got nobody who's helped get me there or that I have to answer to or who has any better way to call me, except for maybe my wife and my kids or something, than any other voter in the state of Missouri. And that's got to be a unique proposition compared to all of the other ones. Exception maybe being the Gomez lady who's doing a lot of her own social media and getting a lot of attention for, you know, all the right or wrong reasons. She might accidentally end up in there without being beholden to anybody too, but that'd be a neat opportunity.
It seems like you vacillate between like running campaigns like you've just described, where you do robocalls or digital, but you don't actually like put in a lot of your own money. And then like what happened in 2022, where you put $500,000 of your own money and ran a very serious campaign. So which Mike Carter do you think is going to show up here? The one that is just going to do robocalls and put a minimal amount of effort? Or are you going to actually self-fund again, maybe go on TV and radio and have a real chance of winning this divided field?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same Mike Carter's going to be there regardless. My wife was responsible in a lot of ways of the 22 run. She, much like you were, I believe, this one of the sub parts of your question is, you know, if you're going to be serious about it and run for a serious office, you know, are you going to go out there and do the things that serious retailing politics demands? And my wife was always kind of on me about it. And I liked Pike County, Lincoln County, St. Charles County, the things, the folks and that I interacted with and the parades I was in. It was fun. And I wanted to let her know that, yeah, I can go out there and do that and maybe win it and have some fun while I was doing it. Now, I was in Maui, I think, June 10th through July 5th of that. My kid had his birthday. My wife has stage 4 cancer, and it's under control and has been for.
Oh, I'm really happy to hear that, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. And 6 or 8 years and strong, doing well. But when she wants to do things and our family is important to me, that's what we did right in the middle of that campaign cycle. The things that were most needed by me and my family at that time, we did it. Did I lose 600 votes and lose the election in 22 as a result of that? I don't know, but I'm very fine with it. And it was hard. All of the things I did and the time commitments that I put into it, I don't know. I don't think I want to do it again. I don't know what it has to do with running the office of Secretary of State anyway. Getting out and being at, you know, several parades and all the things that if I can get people to know me in the ways and the messaging, robocalls, TV, radio, whatever. You know, I don't know how many people meet President Trump, and I'm no Trump, but you know, it's probably got to be less than 0.001% of the populace that votes for
him. But I guess my question, I'll shorten my question. Do you plan to put any of your own money into this race?
I already am.
I want to talk about the actual office, which includes monitoring securities, registering businesses, and overseeing elections. Why are you qualified to do this job?
Well, I've been a lawyer since 2004. I do uniform commercial filings with the Secretary of State already. I do fictitious name filings. I do LLC filings. I do articles of organization. I mean, all the things that it does and oversees, I interact with as a user, an end user. I have a login. All the 25 people that work with me at CarShield and Carter Law Offices, we all have logins. I know the process is actually pretty streamlined and pretty good already. I'm certain that there's some bureaucratic folks that, for the most part, are IT folks, I would bet, who are responsible for the PDF uploads and the monitoring and accessibility of the databases that the Secretary of State oversees. So I've got a great familiarity with how the importance of those things are. And do they need a lot of modification? Do I see any problems with them? I'm kind of amazed in the past 10 years what it was like under Carnahan versus now. And that might be more like 15 years. I might have my dates wrong, but there is a pretty big difference. Technology, even at the governmental level, has really caught up. The separation between governmental technology, IT departments, and corporate is not as vast as it once was.
So let's move on to a spicier topic than securities regulation, and that's the term I'm using very deliberately, and that's libraries. As someone who's married to a librarian, I never thought that library policy would be top of mind, but in 2024 it is. And one of the things that Secretary Ashcroft did was put in some rules about things libraries needed to do in order to get state money. Like, they can't put what is perceived as like pornographic books in a children's section, and they need to have policies about how to handle potentially objectionable books. And I need to make this clear to people. Secretary of State does not control libraries. That is done on a local level. I'm sure you know that. You're from St. Charles County. There's been all sorts of stuff about libraries there. How would you kind of handle the library funding aspect of the office if you become Secretary of State?
Yeah, you know, one thing I believe that's important, maybe you know better than I do, but I think we're talking about like threes and fours of thousands of dollars.
It's not a lot of money.
Yeah, it's pretty freaking small. And I think almost all of the libraries who get the money, I'm sure they welcome it, but it's not making or breaking what it is they do day to day. So to the extent that you want to create a policy, Ashcroft, whoever it is that might be in charge of it, Blunt, back when he was doing it, it was not even a topic then, as I understand it. I don't know that you're going to be able to make a lot of change with such small amounts of money that you would otherwise withhold. But to the extent that there are these, books and things that have what we think in them that are inappropriate for folks that are under 8, 10, 12 years old, I'm all for, you know, having those behind a curtain and behind a door with a lock and a key and making sure that, you know, some adults are, taking charge and making sure that those aren't having the improper exposure, that kind of thing. But I haven't looked a lot into how we would control the funds that go to them. And I suspect, based on some of the limited feedback I've had, libraries ultimately don't care a ton about a couple thousand bucks.
Yeah. And I think that it gets into like a broader question about like oversight of local libraries. We had Senator Mary Elizabeth Coleman on, and she would like to see library boards elected across the state. I don't believe like the St. Charles County Library Board is elected. I think Steve Ellman appoints people to that. I could see the benefit and disadvantage to that, but also the Secretary of State's office can only advocate for something like that. They can't magically make all library boards elected. What do you kind of think about that idea? Or is that an idea you haven't really thought much about?
Yeah, I believe there are some elected, you know, library boards, if I'm not mistaken. There's nothing wrong with that. We've seen kind of during COVID and post-COVID some of the importance of what the flashpoints are that the school boards have become. And you saw parents get more involved in those things than they ever had in the past. I think ultimately that's a good thing. I don't like some of the heated right and left discussions that kind of get out of control. But and the personal attacks, but you know, it is good that the focus has come. If there could be more focus on the library boards and their activities, that can only be a positive thing. I do think, in some ways, you know, libraries are a dying breed. I think most folks probably go there to like study more so than they do to pick up a lot of materials. Everything is so ubiquitous, you know, on the internet and that now, and Amazon, and I don't know how they're surviving. I'm assuming it's going to be like McDonald's, right? You know, 5-10 years ago, or at least pre-pandemic, there was a McDonald's on every corner, into your street, into your court, and now they've kind of been shrinking. They're killing off some McDonald's and servicing larger geographic areas. And not that we should equate fast food with library reading or anything, but I suspect there's going to have to be a downsizing of the libraries throughout the state and throughout the country so that they can afford to remain there, because they're just not at the top of the food chain when it comes to monetary allocations from the government, it doesn't seem like to me.
One of the prime roles of Secretary of State is to coordinate with the county's local election officials. What would be your posture forging those relationships, especially if those officials have much different visions on how elections should be run?
You know, I think mostly, you know, being involved, trying to police them to some extent. I'm sure there are woman and man, you know, power shortages as far as, you know, being present in every 114 counties of the state. I don't know if it was Peggy Hubbard or the Hubbard back in 2016 when Mr. Franks or whichever.
Penny Hubbard. Peggy Hubbard is somebody who I think is somebody who's tried to run in Illinois.
Yeah, that's right.
But they do have similar names, so yeah. I understand the confusion on that, but continue.
Yeah, it was Penny and was it Bruce Franks?
Yes.
They got a reelection, you know, based on bringing in armloads of ballots, you know, absentee and otherwise. And, you know, to the extent that you can train folks up and at least have a watchful eye, that they respect and they think you can do something with the long arm of the Secretary of State coming in to bear some kind of pressure on them. I think that would be a good starting point, that, you know, making certain that if we get those types of complaints, that they're going to be looked into. And then also as a training on the front end. I know some of the Board of Election, Kurt Barr out in St. Charles County, he's the director of elections. Him and Ashcroft, if I'm not mistaken, are in contact quite a bit, seem to be in kind of lockstep. I'm sure that's not the case in all of the 114 counties, but to the extent that you could have that relationship that I understand they have with more and more of the folks throughout the state, that's only going to be a benefit. And if you let them know where you're coming from and what's important to you and that what you're not going to put up with, I believe you can telegraph that and have some meaningful impact.
One of the ideas that's been broached in this campaign is hand counting ballots instead of putting them through election machines. What do you think of this idea?
I think you should have the back channel to look and count them as hand ballots. So what I talk about mostly, and I have had very little to zero pushback, and I'd say going back to Cook and Blunt and Ashcroft and anybody that I've kind of been around, we all, most of us who went to high school from 1978 to 2024, we have these Scantrons that we fill out little bubbles on. We put them through machines. They're not connected to the internet. They don't have a USB plug-in, but they do take pieces of paper through them, look at the dots that have been filled out, and pump out results. And I believe that gets rid of a lot of the concerns that folks seem to say with regard to Dominion and whatever it is that your word of the day is. And then to the extent that you don't like what the results are that pumped out, let's say there's a, I don't know, 0.001% difference between two candidates that run or three. Well, if you want to, you can bring some folks in and they can count 32,000 ballots with their eyeballs and hanging Chad style back to the Gore Bush 2000 days. It's there, but you can also trust the machinery at a very basic level, because all it is doing is tabulating the dots that roll through it. And I haven't heard anybody ever once, now I'm only half a century year old, but I have never heard a push of like all of the erroneous grading that's happening at our public schools or our private institutions throughout the United States. Everybody seems to be pretty Scantron friendly. So if we use that, I think we'll be in good shape.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. And we're back on Politically Speaking. Our guest today is Municipal Judge Mike Carter, who is running to become Missouri's next Secretary of State. One of the biggest changes during the Ashcroft administration was the implementation of an early voting period. See, I told you we'd get back to that, where you can go in person to a designated place and cast your ballot for any reason. What do you think of that system, and would you have changed it at all?
Yeah, I'm not real excited about going to vote early for any reason. Now, if the mechanisms are in place that you said in person, right?
Yes.
Yeah, in this case, the in-person early absentee voting, yeah.
Yeah. So if they're voting there in the flesh, in person, and they cast it with the same way that they would on voting day. I have less of a problem with that. But to the extent that they grab something, someone else brings back a notarized copy of what their grandma or grandpa did, I'm not happy or hip with that. But to the extent it mimics and is exactly like the day of voting that we have designated, and it's checked and verified, that's fine with me.
Okay, so if you've listened to this show for any period of time, one of the issues I kind of get hot and bothered over is this excuse-based system we have right now. If you want to get an absentee ballot and you don't go in person to do it during the two-week period, like you get it either by requesting it with your election authority and it gets mailed to you and you mail it back, you have to check off an excuse that like you're going to be somewhere else that day or you're sick or something. And every election official I've talked to has said that the system is a joke. There's no way to enforce any of the excuses or look into any of them. And they frankly think that it's basically incentivizing dishonesty because people can just check a box and get away with it. And I think their point is this excuse-based system is so worthless, it's not worth preserving anymore. I know that's probably a stronger Jason Rosenbaum question than usual, but what do you think about that?
Well, I would ask you, but not make you answer, you know, do you know why Hunter Biden is having a trial today? And the answer is he filled out a checkbox when he got a firearm and said that he wasn't on drugs.
And by the way, he was found guilty of that. I'm not sure if you heard
that. I didn't hear that. And so those things can matter, you know, to the extent that you can or cannot verify those later or prove them. It looks like he's going to be bearing some consequences for falsely checking a box that otherwise he probably gave very little thought to back when he did it and he was getting a firearm. Is voting as important as buying a firearm? I'm going to say absolutely yes. I'm not a big fan, if I understand the question correctly. I don't want folks voting absentee any more than they absolutely necessarily have to. I think you should have to swear an oath, show a picture of the doctor's note why you can't make it, something with your kids are going to be out of town for soccer, a paid for airplane flight. Like, I don't think even those things should qualify. If you want to vote and you care about where you live and who's elected and who's in office, get to the voting polls the day of the election and do what everybody has done for, you know, hundreds of years, if I'm not mistaken. Is it perfect? No. But if you respect it the way that I do, you can show up. And if you absolutely cannot make it there like a veteran, like we talked about earlier, hey, let's verify it and make sure you need that accommodation.
For some people, you know, they have work that day and it's hard. They might have to get a bus to go to their polling place. They may not be able to easily access their polling place on actual election day. So maybe a way to circumvent that would be to make election day a state holiday. Would that be something you would support?
Well, I would just say kind of forcefully, I do not care if they have to work or whatever they need to go and vote. Most all the places that I've ever had to do with, I've got about 1,500 or 2,000 employees now. They can all go and vote anytime election day's here. We don't penalize anybody for it. I've never heard of an employer penalizing anybody for going to vote, but I could be mistaken. What was the second part of your question?
You know, a solution to that would be possibly making for, you know, it's great that your employees have that time. Other employees might not be able to have that time. So a way to circumvent that would be to make having election day maybe be a state holiday so people have off so they do have that time. Would that be something you would support?
I would. Now, there were some logistics about it. Ashcroft and others have told me that, you know, once you make it a holiday, national or otherwise, folks start going to the Ozarks and spending that time at the, you know, doing things with their family. And it's not a priority for them to come and work at the polls and getting poll workers on a holiday. And it just gets tougher. Some of the schools, I don't know if you've ever heard where, and I don't know if this is directly related, but it's another logistical problem I never thought of, is that supposedly there's a contingent of parents who don't want regular citizens coming through their kids' school during the school day to come vote in the gymnasium and whatnot. And so these holidays and designated places to be able to vote get to be a little bit tougher. Now, if it's a holiday and schools are out, that would help. I have no problem with having a holiday to vote or even on Saturdays. But again, I heard that it's hard to get poll workers and whatnot on the weekend. And so it can be hard logistically to accommodate that. So those are just some of the things I've heard, and I'd have to bury myself in that and figure out, hey, can those be overcome?
So one of the things that will be on the ballot probably in November is a measure that would ban ranked choice voting, and it would also, without question, ban non-citizens from voting. What do you think about that proposal?
Yeah, I buy into the, as I understand the language, if I can recollect it here in the Constitution right now, that, you know, all citizens of the state can vote. And I'm a lawyer by trade since 2004, and I can understand that the interpretation of words and words have meaning, that can be important. And it does sound like to me that it's possible that some non-citizens would be able to vote under the current language. And to those folks who try to act like they don't believe that needs to be clarified, I would submit they're being disingenuous. I have a full-throated approval of clarifying that we need to have current, factual, verifiable citizenship of someone before they're casting votes for the people who go and represent us in Jeff City or even D.C. For that matter. And what was the second part?
Which I think is already illegal. Like, I don't think you can do that. I think the question is whether non-citizens could vote in local elections. I mean, and I said this to Senator Coleman, I am not arguing that somebody who's an undocumented immigrant should be able to vote in anything because they've already broken the law by coming here. I think what people are suggesting should at least be discussed is if you're in this country legally, a green card holder, have lived in the country for a number of years, are paying taxes, have a job, I think the argument is, like, why shouldn't you be able to vote for mayor or board of aldermen president if you are trying to at least get on the pathway to be a citizen, which often takes a long time.
So yeah, you're here visiting by the grace of United Statesians, the elected officials, the Congress, whoever it is that have put the laws in place. You have been allowed to come here and do the things, all of which you explained. You don't get to come here and some diplomats and whatnot pay no taxes and things, as I'm sure you're aware, while they're here. They can park wherever they want. But regular folks on HB1s or whichever it is, or H1Bs, I probably got the letters backwards, they're here. They're having a good time. They're experiencing what it is to be here and deriving many, many, many benefits. But they just don't get to participate in that process. And that's the way it's set up. That's not the way them participating is not contemplated by the Constitution, by the laws that I'm aware of. And so for people to say just morality or whichever should supersede what it is that we've decided as a republic, instantly, because we think we're deciding the fair and unfair aspects of who should be able to do something because they're paying some taxes. They're already getting all the benefits they deserve as soon as they show up and avail themselves to all the things that we have going on here in the United States and the state of Missouri.
Well, what about the ranked choice voting part? Are you a fan of ranked choice voting, not a fan of ranked choice voting? What's kind of your opinion about that?
At first blush, I think it has, you know, like if your average eighth grader was to look at it, it just kind of sort of makes sense. Anybody who's kind of less than 50%, maybe we should get to the point that they are. The problem is it then gets a lot more complicated from there. Make a first choice, second choice, third choice. It turns into, like, I don't know if you guys ever heard of the law school admissions test, but before you go to law school, you take this test. And one of the questions, they used to have this logic section, is Mary can sit on the bench on Thursdays. Frank can't sit on the bench on Fridays. And then June can only sit on them on Saturdays. Here are the people that are here today. Who's on the bench? And I've not articulated it perfectly, but that's how ranked choice vote gets by the time you start to implement it in the booth when you're trying to pick these folks in some kind of order. If you don't like this person, then who's your next choice? Who's your next choice? I just think people regularly lose track of what the heck's going on.
I want to move on to making it harder to amend the Constitution, which has been a huge subject in Missouri politics for the last couple of years at minimum, probably extends beyond that. So if you are Secretary of State, do you plan to advocate to make the Constitution more difficult to amend?
I've got a double-edged answer to this, I think. If I can remember both of them. One is that the federal constitution has to be approved not only by the legislative body itself first at the federal level, but then 3/4 of the states have to approve the amendment. You're probably both aware of the Equal Rights Amendment that was kind of pushing around for a better part of 30, 40 years. They actually kind of lost track of, you know, how many states have approved it? Did we get close to the 3/4? And at what point through a temporal span of time do you kind of lose the validity of the first 28 states that did agree because you're 30 years removed from when they gave their approval? So it gets kind of complicated. It's super hard to amend the federal constitution. I think something less than that, but more difficult than now, should be put in place to amend the state constitution. I remember in law school, we had a class called state constitution, and everyone in there was surprised that it took, you know, one grain of sand more than 50% by the folks that show up to vote to modify the state's constitution, because it just seemed ridiculously easy. Now, on the flip side, let me finish that thought. It should take something like 60% of the folks voting to get a constitutional amendment passed and approved. On the flip side, though, I think it should be easier to get a proposed amendment in front of the voters.
Can you elaborate on that? That's an interesting point.
To my knowledge now, you have to have a certain percentage of folks within, let's say, 6 of the congressional district.
I think it's like 8% of registered voters or something like that. But yeah, yes, continue.
Within 5 or 6 of the districts in order to get it onto the ballot. Right now, if you're aware, also, if you want to run as an independent candidate, you have to do something similar to that within the district or the county that you're going to run in as an independent, who you don't have an R or a D on your name. It should be much easier to get on the ballot as an independent. I don't even know historically, and I'm getting far afield here, I don't even know historically how come the R and Ds, which purport to be private entities, and I'm running as a Republican, but they get some type of government-sanctioned permission to be on the ballot, and yet they want to force the government to help them figure out who can be included and excluded, although they're private entities. It's bizarre to me that it's that difficult to get on as an independent. And the same thing goes for the amendment to the Constitution. Trying to run around and get that amount of signatures for your regular citizen, especially those folks who say, well, we want the citizens to be able to act outside of the legislative confines and that. Well, for most citizens, the ones you were talking about who can't get off work and go vote, to pull together that amount of signatures and put it on the ballot is a monumental, Herculean task that is basically insurmountable. But so it should be easier. Do I know exactly how much easier? I would say, in the abstract, 50% easier than it is now to get it on the ballot.
And I want to clarify. So you said once it's on the ballot, then it should be 60% to pass. I'm curious, kind of once it's on the ballot, you think it should be a little bit tougher and not a simple majority?
It would be neat to try to borrow from what I laid out earlier, the feds. So you got the legislative body, Senate and House have to approve it at the federal level for the constitutional amendment. I think there's 27 right now. And then 3/4 of the states have to approve it in order for it to make it to be a constitutional amendment. So we have 114 counties. I'm not hyper familiar with how many of all of them have county councils. I'm supposing a majority of them have functioning county councils. And so to the extent that we wanted to put that to the county or to some of the municipalities, if they 2/3 or 3/4 of them would approve the state amendment or something like that, I might be into doing that kind of a thing. Now, if we want to keep it in the citizens or the voters' hands and they pass it just by simply going to the ballot box, I'm thinking 55, 60, maybe 2/3 of them should agree to it because it's such a lift. It should be more of a lift to make a constitutional amendment.
On changing the state statute, right now there is nothing stopping a statute change from passing in November and then the state legislature turning around and undoing it, or at least modifying it, the very next session. Would you support a state law or rules that at least for a period of time either protected or shielded voter passed state statutes from being changed in a major way?
I know back in 99, if I'm not mistaken, Senator Keevan was pushing conceal and carry, right? And so it got on the ballot and the voters voted it down 51-49. And then I think exactly like you're explaining, if I'm following your thread of logic here, representatives down at the General Assembly, they ended up voting conceal and carry in, basically to the opposite of what it is the voters did at the booth. And I always was curious about how do you reconcile those two things? And I really haven't come up with an answer. What it sounded like you were suggesting is there might be some kind of waiting period before the General Assembly can attack something like that again after it's been recently voted on by the voters or the citizens. I haven't put a lot of thought into it, but it does provide some type of weird conundrum. If you've got virtually all the folks who at least pay their respects to going down to vote at the voting booth on election day, and they go, look, we don't want it, it's 51-49. And then the legislature a year or two later says, well, you didn't really mean what you said. We're the representatives down here, and we're going to tell you what you really think. I do have an issue with that knee-jerkedly, but I haven't explored it. But I have thought about it a good amount of time since 99, because I remember where I was when that all happened.
If Missourians vote for a constitutional amendment that legalizes abortion, do you believe that would dampen the enthusiasm for Republicans to pursue that threshold boost, since passage of it would then make it harder to remove or change the abortion legislation amendment?
You know, I don't know. I'm certain that there's been some type of race to the ballot box to beat each other, right? I think both, if I'm understanding you, you know, you've got two sides, pro-life, pro-choice, who are kind of trying to get that before the voters. Either one, make it harder to do it, or two, get it through before it is harder to do it. I would suppose potentially what you're alluding to does have some basis in reality, and that is once it became more difficult, if you wanted to switch back, just like we were talking about with the conceal and carry in 99, you would presumably, as a pro-life person, want the same opportunity to come back at a 51-49 threshold and win it back the other way, to the extent you had the money behind it or something. So I would think, you know, if what's passed is prologue and the pro-lifers and pro-choicers are going to continue with their desires and to effectuate change and get things like Dobbs to happen after 30, 40 years of Roe, yeah, they're going to want to put it back, and they're not going to want it to be more difficult. I'm certain that's the case.
And that is my last question for you. And I think Jason's also questioned out.
I'm all questioned out, and he did a great job answering our questions. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. We really appreciate you being on the show. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And you can read all of our work on both politics and elections at stlpr.org. And Mike Carter, where can people find you on the internet where you want to be found?
You can go to MikeCarter.com. And like you guys, I think, said earlier, I think you did anyway, I do a Justice and Journalism with Judge Mike Carter show on Fox and ABC, and have done so for about 5 years. And you can see full length, just like you guys are so usefully doing for your listening public here. We have 30-minute interviews. Mike Kehoe, Igel, Ashcroft, Vivek, every state leader is on there if you want to check them out and see what they have to say to you before you make it to the ballot box in August and November.
All right. Thank you so much. And until next time, so long.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.